We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello, and I think I know what you're thinking. You're thinking it's another episode of Fusion Patrol, and you would be right. I'm Eugene. I don't know what he's thinking, though.
Well, those sensitive listening to the podcast will have heard me projecting my name into their heads, but for the rest of you, I'm Simon.
And tonight we are starting a new series on Fusion Patrol, 1979's BBC Scotland production of the Omega Factor, which I now have to ask the question, because I didn't notice it in the show. Is Omega the British pronunciation of Omega, or is Omega the Time Lord name pronunciation of the word Omega? How do you pronounce it?
I lost the subtleties there. The
Omega British one being, and Omega.
Ah, I think it was Omega, but it's only mentioned it one time in the whole episode. So.
Right, and I kind of buzzed past it, and I'm so used to hearing it pronounced as in the Time Lord's name, that it would have gone by me. I didn't think of it until I was preparing for this episode, and I go, oh, yeah, I wonder. I wonder how it would be if the announcer on the BBC was saying what show was up next. I'll pay attention next time, I guess. Anyway, this is a 1979 show, as we mentioned. It's features a guy whose name I didn't write down. What was the main actor's name? Do you remember?
The name of the actor?
Yes.
James Hazeldine,
I think. Sounds right. That sounds right. We're trying to avoid spoilers, so I'm not looking at the Wikipedia page or anything like that, because neither Simon nor I have seen this show, nor do we know a whole lot about it. So we're going in cold, and so let's begin this journey and see what we're going to find out. And I'm going to start with a summary that might be a little more detailed than some of our summaries. Reporter Tom Crane is having a nightmare. Again. It's a nightmare he's had many times before. He is powerless in a white room with something that terrifies him, but remembers little else. We, in the audience, see that he's strapped in a chair being shown an Escher print. Tom has recently done a successful series of articles on the occult, and now he's starting a new series on psychic powers. His investigation takes him to Edinburgh to meet a man named Drexler, who is apparently a powerful psychic and a man in hiding from his past. Tom meets with a friend of his wife, Anne, and some of her associates. One of them tells Tom that Drexler's powers might include somehow causing people to kill themselves to protect himself from investigation. Drexler meets with Crane and implies that Crane has psychic powers of his own, which he suggests would allow him to find a local missing person if he chooses to pursue it himself. He also warns Tom off him, saying he will give him a demonstration to scare him, and if he doesn't heed his warning, a demonstration he will regret forever. That night, Tom is terrorized as he walks the dark streets of Edinburgh. Tom does take an interest in the local missing persons case and begins to have visions, which lead him to the unfortunate suicide victim's body. Was she a victim of Drexler's powers? The next day, Drexler is packed up and gone. Tom's wife comes to Edinburgh to spend time with him, but before she arrives by train, he is sure he sees her in a car with Anne's associate. When he picks her up at the station, she denies it. That night, driving back from dinner on a dark, lonely road, Tom begins to have more visions. A girl appearing in the road ahead of him causes him to swerve off the road, wrecking his car. His wife is killed. Back in London, after the funeral, a mysterious man appears at Tom's door. He informs Tom that his wife worked for him at a top-secret government entity known as Department 7, based in Edinburgh. His wife had been spying on him because Tom is a latent psychic. Tom's brother, who also lives in Edinburgh, but curiously managed to avoid his brother during his recent trip, also works for Department 7 and has been helping with experiments projecting that recurring dream at Tom. Anne and all her associates also work for Department 7. Won't you come work for us too, Tom? And he agrees. End of episode. So, just out of initial reactions. What do you think?
It started a bit cold, I have to say, and it was the theatricality, I think, that kind of got to me a bit, and the fact that every sort of scene was a two-hander, and it played out in quite a sort of stagey way.
Mm-hmm.
But somewhere along the line, this really got to me, and I got really into it. And it is the kind of, because this is, I mean, it's the best part of 40 years old, this show. And I think in the last 20 years, at least, TV has just changed so much. You simply would not see anything like this anymore.
No.
And yet there is something, something to do with partly the pacing and partly the sort of social attitude or something about it that gives it a real kind of sinister, mysterious edge that would be very, very difficult to kind of match now.
Hmm.
So it just reminded me of a lot of shows that I remember watching. I'm slightly too young to remember watching this when it was on,
mm-hmm.
but this kind of television, and I miss it. This is good stuff.
I agree. I mean, I enjoyed this. I enjoyed this through my wife and I watched it, and we were, you know, both right there at the end, and kind of upset that episode one ended when it did. It's like and I mean, it wasn't exactly a cliffhanger, but kind of in a way it was, because
it feels much more like a sort of serialized story than a sort of formula,
right.
Series. So, you know, compared to other shows like, I guess Blake 7 is fairly contemporary.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm struggling to think of any other 1970s shows of the style. Well, actually, even Blake 7 starts off in the establishment
mm-hmm.
with a slightly more serialized feel to it. And the episodes that I particularly enjoyed, actually, were the ones that were kind of setting things up, and therefore one episode ran into the next.
One thing go ahead.
Well, I rather liked that. It was rather a nice change. I had somehow imagined, from the kind of common description that is given to this show, is it's kind of precursor to The X-Files or whatever, and I love The X-Files, don't mm-hmm. get me wrong, but I was expecting, therefore, something a bit more formulaic, and it was quite nice to have something that sort of played out in a way that kind of promises to continue next time.
I thought it was... One of my complaints frequently about American shows, although it may apply to British shows in certain cases, but I can't think of any that do this, is this sort of pilot episodes frequently have this break between the formulaic part that they're trying to set up. So here's what the show is going to be like in the future. But we have to get all this establishment stuff out of the way. And so there's
the arrival in The Prisoner, for example?
Well, not so much the arrival in The Prisoner. I'm struggling to think of a specific example, but on American TV. But, you know, you have a high concept. $6 Million Man, you have a high concept. You have to get this guy out there, and you have to blow him up and knock his arms and legs off and rebuild him and go through that whole process. And that should be a story in of itself, okay? But they can't leave it that way. They have to also then send him on his first mission, which is only 15, mm-hmm. 20 minutes long at the end of the episode. So it doesn't even kind of rate as a full one-hour adventure for him, but they just feel like they have to do it. So there's this sort of two-part graft to the first episode, even if the episode is a little bit long. But here, we are watching an interesting story about a man conducting an investigation, and you do not see where it's going, and I have no clue what episode two will be like. I have not been in any way given anything to go on as to whether or not the next episode will start with him hopping into Department 7 and start investigating psychic crimes, or whether it's going to go into, you know, we're researching Tom's abilities, or whether they're going to go on a hunt for Drexler. I have no idea where this show is going, because it almost if I didn't know that there was a Department 7 in this, and I didn't know that Louise Jameson was a regular in the show, I would not have seen it coming. When the guy knocks on the door and says, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help you," and I just didn't see that coming. And then when it ends on that scene where they basically say, "Yeah, by the way, your wife of 8 years has been spying on you. Your brother has been helping conduct unethical experiments on you. Your wife's friends have been following you in Edinburgh and keeping track of you the whole time." I mean, everybody you know, and for all I know, the flamboyant man in the pub who sent him on the course of Drexler is part of Department 7 and may very well have set him on that path. We don't know. But this man has been stitched up. And it's not in evidence at all until you get right to the end of the first episode. You're like, wow, where does this go?
Except that, I don't know where it goes. And you're right, it is wide open. And it is a good twist, but it's also interesting in the sense that it does feel set up. Or not necessarily even set up. It feels like suddenly certain things click into place because you understand now
why his brother was with the guy
so you've seen Martindale with those little glimpses where you knew there was something, but also some of the things that were in plain sight. Why was Anne so keen for him to come straight back to Edinburgh at the funeral, for example? So you get some little clues to that, but also I think part of the reason why that works is there is this very kind of almost stilted style to, I'll say, the acting, to the kind of the way that the character Crane acts. So you know, it's not about the acting, but it's this kind of casualness, or casualness is maybe not the right word, but it's the sense in which he's not necessarily easy to read, if that makes sense.
Okay.
And again, I think this is from a very different style. I don't know whether, you know, having lived through it and seen things change gradually, whether if I could step back in time, whether you'd see a real kind of cultural change in that respect. But I can certainly think of examples of where you see. I mean, I've kind of criticised Gareth Thomas's performance when we've discussed
just for a moment
Rog Blake on your Blake 7 podcasts, and the fact that I think he's not he's giving a slightly odd, what feels like a slightly odd performance, but I wonder if some of that is this kind of this 70s man style of not wearing your heart on your sleeve, of not showing your emotions. And I think of that scene in Hitchhikers where Ford learns that he's on Zaphod's ship and Zaphod's watching him on the monitor and he learns Ford's there. And they're both super excited. And most of all, they're excited about the fact of how cool and offhand they're going to be and being pre-warned not show their emotions when they bump into one another. And so I wonder whether that's all a kind of way of projecting a certain certain persona.
Isn't that the stereotypical British reserve?
But is that still true? I mean,
well, you know, stereotypes don't go away too quickly.
But the if you look at TV drama now, the emotions aren't there.
Oh yeah, now they have to pour them out.
You know, you think of that last scene with Brown, what's his name, turning up from Department 7. Mm-hmm. If Crane were played by, I don't know, David Tennant or someone,
oh yeah,
it would all be there.
Yeah,
but
he'd be angry. He'd be flying around the room. He'd be breaking down and crying. Yeah, the whole nine yards.
Yeah,
but
exactly, and so I think that what's there is quite different, and also it allows for because then everything is in the subtexts. So you actually have to spend a lot more time guessing what he's thinking, you know, when he's confronting Drexel, when he's at the graveside and he turns away and says, "What a waste." I mean, what an extraordinary line. He's just buried his wife.
Mm-hmm.
But he's, there are no tears. There's nothing. Yeah.
He's the stoic hero. And then that's an incredible amount of, it could be preserved that way, as an incredible amount of self-control. And perhaps it's an unhealthy amount of self-control and unrealistic, which I...
unrealistic, because what you don't get is a man struggling to control his emotions.
Right.
What you get is a man in complete control of his emotions.
Well, it's obviously been a couple days. I mean, give him a chance to, you know, he's had some time to cool off.
Well, yes, it's the choice of what we get to see on screen. So maybe he's holding himself together because it's the funeral service and he just needs to get through that, and then he can go and sit in a darkened room and drink himself into oblivion with his memories. And maybe that's what, but we don't see that. Mm-hmm. And I find those choices very interesting. And I think that because Drexel is incredibly understated as a villain as well, and I found myself really appreciating that, because you kind of think any modern villain would be a bit more kind of barking or OTT, whereas you have this actually. You could very easily mistake him as a harmless antiquarian bookseller, but there is a menace, and it comes out when Crane pushes him.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like he's going around kind of going, I'm mad, me, I'm mad.
I do not like that, and we've discussed that. I mean, the further down the path of I'm mad, you make a villain, and there is that sort of school of, well, why would anybody be a villain unless they were mad? It's like, well, maybe they're just evil. It's like, I believe people can be intrinsically evil, or have an agenda that is self-serving to the point of not caring what they do to other people. So I can take that off this guy.
I'm not criticizing Michelle Gomez or anything, you know. I know where these conversations have cropped up before.
Those are taken to the super extreme. I mean, John Sim and Michelle Gomez, y'all both like way off the end. But it's not, you know, that's on the spectrum. A lot of times now, the villain has to have a certain amount of madness to them, or they think the audience won't accept them, and I don't know.
It's not just that. I wonder if they think the audience will forget they're the villain or something, or they're so worried about the members of the audience who have switched on in the 38th minute. They need the villain to be obviously the villain so that they can all keep up.
Well, I'll take an example here. A show I did not watch. I don't know whether you would have. I think it was quite popular in Britain. But it's about the same age, and that's Dallas, where J.R. Ewing, which was Larry Hagman's character, was a complete and absolute villain. I mean, he was just a cheating, lying, crooked, bad... And he was, like, the star of the show because everybody loved him. He somehow took that villainy and made it, you know, the cool, like... whether that's just an 80s thing or what, but there's a lot of that, people compare that to Avon in Blake 7, although yeah. I, that's when you're not barking mad, but when you do have that sort of self agenda, you can be a sympathetic character.
And I'm not saying Avon is unsympathetic, but he's a good example of someone who you look at him and you know, he's not the hero, and because he's always got that slight, you know, his sort of fixed sneer and everything, you get a very strong sense of it just by looking at him. And you know, similarly with Delgado's performance as the Master, he was the star. He kept coming back
mm-hmm.
because he was popular through his portrayal of a villain. And anytime you looked at it, you would never mistake him for anything but the villain, even if... You might argue that, you know, subsequent actors in the role have gone even more extreme. At that time, even then, you would have known. Whereas I think there's something about the way that Drexel is portrayed in this that means that you have to actually listen to the story to understand what's going on. There are moments of threat where he squares up to Crane, and obviously, you know, if Crane is our hero, so we know this guy's not all good. But you actually have to listen to it to understand quite how bad he is, and the fact that he, you know, is at least suspected of these murders. And we have no idea what his motive. You know, we don't know if he's pure evil, or, you know, if he's mad, or what. There is no clue yet in the performance we've had.
And also in the script, there's no clue to me whether or not episode 2 they're going to take Drexler down for killing his wife, or whether it's going to be episode 10.
Yeah.
Whether he's going to be a continuing theme throughout the show. Don't know. Which I like that. I like the fact that I don't know. And I think he could probably... Well, I mean, the showing up of his girl at the graveside does imply... Well, it could still be just a two-parter and we go off and take him down at the end. I don't know.
I'm rather hoping he will be around for a bit longer than just one more episode. But
considering they've kind of made him out to be like the greatest of the psychics.
Yeah.
So I guess that, you know, he kind of needs to be the anti-Tom Crane in the course of the story. I'm going to ask this question. So we've talked a little bit about the sort of staginess and the acting, and obviously actors like Louise Jameson have been in other things that viewers may have seen who listen to this podcast. At BBC proper.
Thank you.
Yeah, at BBC proper, not BBC Scotland. And one of the few things...
There will be letters.
There will be letters. When I was handed this disc... Now, my friend David, who has been on the show, is the one that had this set of discs, which are available in the US and the UK. So if you want to watch this show, it's 10 episodes, go find the DVDs and support my stuff. You know, that was basically what he said when he handed it to me. He says, well, just remember, this is a BBC Scotland production. And if you think about it, Sapphire and Steel is about the same period of time, too. That's ITV. ITV? No.
Yeah.
Was it ITV? Was it one of the other small ones? Well, it wasn't BBC. it wasn't BBC in London. Let's put it that way. And BBC in Scotland.
I think at the time you only had BBC and ITV, so I think you ruled out the other option.
Well, it wasn't Thames TV or anything like that. But
Thames was a... ITV's the network. Thames was one of the regional companies that's part of ITV.
Yeah.
So it would have been produced by... I think it might have been Yorkshire TV, but I cannot remember. But it was
their
ITV.
Facilities and... set building do not appear to be on quite on the same level as maybe BBC London's output in 1979. And I wonder if there is a smaller town feel with regards to the production crew as well that may have had some effect on this. Although the director, Paddy Russell, has done at least 4 episodes of Doctor Who, at least of this episode. I don't know what Paddy Russell does anymore of this series, but so it's not completely devoid of crossover talent from other BBCs. But I think
what you have to bear in mind is this is not made for broadcast in Scotland. This is made for broadcast across the UK.
And it was BBC One when it aired. That's right.
Yeah, and like just as Doctor Who now is made by BBC Wales, the production values aren't any less. Where it's made.
Now there aren't. That's right. But I get the feeling that back then there was. I mean, there's a lot of criticism about the BBC for lavishing more of its talent and effort and money on their London productions, which is, you know, part of the reason that Television Centre has closed down and they've sent more stuff, major shows, off to BBC Wales and... I want to. So in 1979, I have heard from more than one person that BBC Scotland was a second class citizen in the BBC, as were any of the other local production facilities.
I think what you might find is that you had a harder time getting people. You know, it might have been a less popular thing to be, because you've still got access, in theory at least, you've got access to the same resources and the same, you know, as you've mentioned, Paddy Russell and the actors in the show, doesn't make any difference. You've got the same people wherever you're making it.
Mm.
But yes, perhaps it's more difficult.
Cameramen,
to get
sets builders, things like
people
that.
People going up to Edinburgh, and indeed, perhaps there are, I don't know, more. Fewer large studios or whatever. I mean, it doesn't seem to me that this is actually a show that needs a lot of elaborate large sets.
No, especially since they were all pretty much two-hand.
Yeah, exactly.
In other words, it was designed
with that constraint in mind. I don't know, but
yeah. See, it could be because we have smaller studios, or we have just a different way of. I don't know. I mean, it will continue. I will say they made effective use of Edinburgh locations.
Well, yeah. I mean, first shot that had Edinburgh Castle in the background, I thought
that could have been stock, but yeah,
I thought it was CSO. I honestly didn't believe they'd gone to Edinburgh to film it. So
I believe they did. Yeah, when they were in Edinburgh Station, and she pulled up in the train, I'm looking at that and I go, that has not changed that much since from then to 19. Or 2000 when I was there. I mean, the roof's a little better and the turnstiles are cleaner, but that looks like the same train station to me. So,
oh yeah, but the old HSTs in 19 whatever liveries, 1979. So 10 years later, those liveries were gone or going.
But
I just get a bit train nostalgic now.
Well, it's a little tear to the eye. It's like, anyway. Go ahead.
But actually, you know, I mean, I did have that criticism about the production values, some of the location footage looking a little bit odd. The real thing that struck me about the production was I found the editing really interesting. And obviously part of the editing was some of these things around Crane's sensitivity or psychic ability was being suggested by, you know, looking at a picture and then editing all of the superimposing all of these images and then cutting back to him looking at it. And so some of those were technical limitations of what might be done much, much more effectively using a computer now.
Mm-hmm.
But actually some of the basic stuff, like when you reach the end of a scene, it just cuts straight to the next scene. Literally, like the end of a line of dialogue, jump cut, and you're at the start of the first line of dialogue in the next scene. Nothing to establish it, no breathing space or anything. And again, it was a TV style that just felt very foreign. You know, being familiar with modern shows, I got used to it quite quickly, but it did kind of stand out to me as being an interesting choice.
There were a couple of, I can't say that caught my attention too much, but I seem to recall in the morning when he's getting out of bed, there's obviously a fair jump in time between that and when he's like not reading the papers or mm-hmm. getting ready to go. And yeah, there is no indication of the passage of time there. I mean, it's the cutting. Yeah,
you have to listen to the dialogue in order to find out, you know, is it the same day? Is it the next day? What's going on here? It's not all being telegraphed to you up front, just like the kind of the emotional portrayals that we've talked about. It's kind of expecting you to do more of the work, I think.
Which is fine. I didn't have any problem with it.
Television
for the lowest common denominator is why this sort of thing has died. I don't know. Or,
well, I mean, we're not necessarily talking about the most highbrow of series here.
No, we're not. But you know, you can write a show that's sort of fanciful and not assume your audience are idiots.
Yeah.
You don't have to work on that assumption, like reality TV. But, yeah, Although, you know, something like a fade transition from a scene where time passes is not, that's not like a new thing. That's
no, I do think it's a choice in this. I do think it's a choice.
And it's kind of handy, and it doesn't take much time. I mean, it doesn't, yeah, it's kind of interesting. I wonder, it'd be interesting to go back and look at the editor and see if they were, or go back and look at some of the stuff Patty Russell has directed elsewhere and see if that's a style, which would include, by the way, Invasion of the Dinosaurs, Pyramid of Mars, and Horror of Fang Rock.
Are they those being the ones she directed?
Well, there was one other, Massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve, but I don't think we're going to get to see much of that.
She directed that?
Uh-huh.
Oh, because she was an assistant before she became a director, wasn't she?
Could be.
But that was a very early episode. Anyway,
in case anyone didn't know that, Patty is short for Patricia, and she is one of the earliest directors at the BBC that's female. And I'm guessing Patty was an attempt to hide that, because that's pretty common, too, using a sort of ambiguous moniker.
Yes.
Since DC Fontana used to do that on Star Trek as well, because right. They just...
Avoid being rejected before they've worked out that you're a woman. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I knew the name. I mean, when it came up at the end, it's, oh, Patty Russell. I know that from Doctor Who. I couldn't tell you which episodes off the top of my head, but I know that director's name. It's distinctive and made me look that one up. So, there's two things. I mean, we could talk about just the general sort of Tom's investigation and the story and finding the dead body, but in a way, I don't want to say they're incidental, but they're part of this ongoing investigation that Tom has to, really, he's not trying to out Drexler or anything like that. He's just trying to learn about psychic abilities so that he can write an article, so that he can do a newspaper story, and he kind of gets caught up in this missing a little unnaturally. If there's anything in this story that kind of feels off to me, it's that he seems to have pulled that out of thin air when he's talking to Drexler as a possible way for him to demonstrate his psychic abilities. And he says, well, why don't you find this missing person? It's like, well, I could, but...
Well, I'm not... No, I... Well, again, I think it's one of the things that's not being telegraphed to us, but I think he has his suspicions about her. He's done his research on Drexel, so...
Oh, you think that Crane thought that before he even went to Drexel? Drexler?
I think so. I think because he doesn't seem to know about him when Oliphant puts him onto him in the pub, and then more or less the next thing is he's in Edinburgh. But I think my assumption at any rate was that in between he had done the background and worked out something about him.
But it's not till after that he talks to the police guy and he gets the file and, you know, asks questions like how the woman disappeared and things like that. So I didn't get that. I just kind of felt like, you know, it was on the front page of the newspaper and he pulled it out. Or Drexler somehow psychically suggested that he should think about it. I don't know. The fact that the woman committed suicide and the fact that Drexler is accused of making people commit suicide when they get too close to him, coincidence, or is he really the guilty party behind that dead woman? Maybe I don't have a reporter's instincts. I wouldn't have necessarily put those two together, but I feel like at the end of the story, it had been kind of telegraphed that was a possibility. But I can't even tell you why I got that by the end.
But it certainly seems like there is... I mean, we learn about how it could... because obviously we don't know at the time, but we learn about how it could fit with these cases involving Drexel in the past. Mm-hmm. So it does raise itself as a possibility. And then whether it's true or whether he's used the image of the woman when he's driving and using the image of the woman to distract him, that's because Crane has mentioned her to him. I don't know. Does he know that Crane found her? I guess we're not quite sure what he knows.
Because we don't know how much time passed. Because of the editing. Is it the next morning that his place is packed up and he's gone? I guess.
I mean, I think it's an interesting question whether he knows or whether he just stumbles across something, and I think that would be interesting to know. Otherwise, my general feeling about this was that Crane's motivation in all of this was really, really quite clear, because he is a journalist, he's wanting to write this article. His initial approach to Drexel is a kind of... he's making friendly overtures, he's willing to kind of stroke his ego a bit to get secret. Him to give the demonstration so that he will cooperate. There's a bit of an edge there, you know. Maybe I was wondering, you know, is he deliberately implying that he could reveal his whereabouts because he knows he's using the name Dexter to avoid people finding him, so he could expose him in the newspaper. So, but then, you know, then you get him coming back and threatening Crane in retaliation, and then they kind of square up. But it all makes sense with all the time. You get the feeling that what Crane wants to do is get his story.
Mm-hmm.
And then if the guy needles him, if he starts to get to him, if his temper rising, that there's a natural reaction there. So from that point of view, I thought it all hung together rather well.
So Crane threatens him with, "I'll scare you." And indeed, when Tom leaves the place and he's walking, suddenly the streetlights are going out and he feels like there's something coming after him, and he hides in a phone booth and the lights go out and a lava lamp is blobbed around the screen and Drexler's eyes, and he's terrified, rightly so, I suppose. Obviously, Tom doesn't give up, having been given a warning that the next one would be a lot worse.
That scene with the streetlights. So mm-hmm. I think you haven't read The Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul. Which is a Dirk Gently book,
right,
by Douglas Adams. And there's a really, really memorable scene that I've always loved in that, where kind of one of the main characters, Kate Schechter, is walking down a street. And as she walks past each streetlight, it goes out.
Happens to me all the time.
She gets more and more scared by it. And I was a bit disappointed to discover that almost 10 years earlier, this had been on a kind of popular, well-known BBC One show that Douglas Adams almost certainly, you know, as a BBC employee, be familiar with.
No. I think Dirk Gently, that's not... If you go on the internet and search right now, I suspect you'll find people talking about that going back a long way. That's a common confirmation bias phenomena where people notice, because those lights
with
tend
street
to go,
lights
with street lights. Absolutely. Mm. I've done it. I can remember it going back well into the 70s. It's, you know, you're walking along, those lights do go out. They overheat and they cut off for a period of time. And of course you don't notice it unless you just happen to be close to it. And happens a few times, and you start thinking, wow, those lights keep going out when I walk under them. And now, of course, I'm sure in Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul, it's carried far beyond what really happens to people, because it probably is like every street light
probability is quickly stack up to...
Right. So it's a thing people have been talking about for a long time. So I wouldn't necessarily say Douglas Adams took it from this, but I mean it's still an effective technique. So I like it. But here's my question: what he then does, presumably what he does to Tom in the car, seems remarkably likely to equally have killed Tom,
yeah,
than his wife. And yet that wasn't really the threat. The threat didn't sound like you're going to die. The threat sounds like you're going to regret it, which, you know, killing his wife did. And Tom's vision at one point was of that pattern that turned out to be the blood of his wife's head on the windscreen of the car. Is there a... So is there conflict of predestiny predictions going on here?
Yes.
Or
so the question is, and I mean, is it Crane or Drexel that have the ability, that have a kind of precognitive ability, if that's what it is, or is it Drexel's powers are so great that he has more than just projecting into Crane's mind these visions, but he's actually controlling, you know, through some kind of incredibly strong telekinesis the events, so that he actually can create the situation, that he can choose how and where the crash takes place, and in effect deliberately kill her. Because you could imagine that might not have been his goal. You know, you will regret it would equally apply if you have some very terrible car crash and either one of you is horribly injured.
Sorry, I just had a thought. I wonder if the woman who was a suicide was also Department 7.
Ooh, interesting thought. Anyone, what's the threat? No, I can't remember the line, but it's something like, no one with any sense would come after me, or however, would cause me trouble. That was it.
Something.
No
like
one with
that.
Any sense would cause me trouble. So why he killed her? It's a really good point.
And she's just a housewife that people know, and pretty ordinary, which, you know, could describe Crane's wife too. So I mean, anybody could be working for Department 7. We've seen that. In fact, for all we know, everyone's working for Department 7. It could be the whole it could be the whole country except for Drexler and Crane. But that's probably the most story.
we have Brown Darby's word that Drexel doesn't work for Department 7.
Right. Okay.
But do we trust him at this point?
Yes, I think so. That's the other big thing I want to mention about this episode that is fascinating by looking at something from 1979. That man walks in the door. He tells Crane his wife's been spying on him, that his brother's been conducting experiments on him, that, you know, they've been studying him and following him, and basically when he goes to Edinburgh, they've been keeping tabs on him the whole time, that they've gone back to his mother, and in confidence, his mother has given them all sorts of information about his psychic and his poltergeist and his telekinesis and his precognition, things that happened that he's completely forgotten as a child. I mean, they have got this guy absolutely positively wrapped up. And when he says, you know, well, what right do you have, which was amazing that he even went that far, the answer is the right of the government to use every assets to protect its own. That's his answer. And I don't think that's an ironic comment, as it would be now. You watch it now. Obviously, every government agency that does stuff like that is an evil, sinister organization. I think this is actually a benevolent government agency that's doing this. And it's staggering to believe that, you know, the difference in attitude that we have towards authority figures. And I think they're not going to come off as evil as we would do them now.
Well, maybe not. But I think that's because it's not going to be as clear cut. It's not simply going to be a question of this is evil. But equally, I'm not sure that they are going to be portrayed as entirely benevolent.
Well, they have been.
So and particularly the kind of, if he is the boss figure, the idea that he would be entirely trustworthy, because he's bound to be the conduit to the political masters, whoever knows about Department 7, whoever is calling the shots, and therefore he's going to be a civil servant who plays the political game and all the rest of it. I have no idea. I'm sure we will find out in the next episode. But I'm not quite ready to kind of throw everything in and just say, okay, I trust everything he says. And if he tells me Drexel never worked for Department 7, then he never worked for Department 7.
Well, okay. I'll go along and say that Drexel does not work for Department 7. But maybe at one point he did, or he was a test subject, or... Yeah, I mean, Tom's been working for Department 7 for a long time and doesn't even know it.
Yeah,
so,
exactly. It's not necessarily a clear-cut question, and I don't think that Derby's going to go out of his way to say, yes, he's not working for us now. But even though you didn't quite ask this, we had this connection with him in 1952 or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm still curious whether Flamboyant Guy is going to turn out to be in similar circumstances. I forgot what his name was, but I'll have another drink.
You mean
please.
the guy in the pub, the
yeah.
red hat of Pat Ferrick type?
Yeah.
Oliphant. You know, I don't know if you can help with this or someone can help with this, but are you familiar with the Fry and Laurie sketches, a bit of Fry and Laurie?
Some.
So there was a story, The Red Hat of Pat Ferrick, where you have Stephen Fry kind of telling this horror story. And actually on the radio these days, John Finnemore in his souvenir programme does something kind of similar. And I think they're taking off kind of 1970s horror anthologies. But I don't know whether they're having a go at anything specific. Is there some actor who played a role like this? I don't know. But it seemed to me that Oliphant was also kind of in that. You call him Flamboyant Guy, but he had the hat and he enjoyed telling these yarns about the paranormal. And it seemed to me so much the same thing.
I agree. I've seen that sort of stereotype before, but not any particular specifics.
Question for listeners: what's the source of all this, and what are the sources?
There is a sort of pub culture that's different from American bar culture, although I think it's getting more common. But you know, meeting in a bar and the sort of colorful character that comes in, and you know, as long as you keep giving me drinks, I'll go. That is sort of British in our eyes, I think.
But I'm not necessarily thinking of this in connection with a pub, though I agree. It's an interesting pub scene. And again, one of the many things in this that is an interesting contrast between the 1970s and now. And well, I mean, just the fact they're smoking in the pub, I guess it's that's a fairly recent change, but it definitely has just like all the kind of brown walls in Grain's apartment and everything. It very much has a strong 1970s feel to it.
Mm-hmm. It definitely does. Well, anyway, I'm intrigued and I'm ready to see the next episode. I think it's off to an intriguing start.
It's the whole thing, and I mean we've had the argument about what is sci-fi, but there is at least a kind of semi scientific approach to the paranormal in
right.
this. It reminded me a bit because we haven't really talked about the sci-fi in the Avengers, but I've posted. And I will link to it in the comments here. Mm-hmm. I've posted about the sci-fi episodes in the Avengers, and there's one which is concerned with the paranormal called Too Many Christmas Trees.
Oh, right.
Which is quite a highly regarded episode, but didn't really work for me because it just suddenly took the idea of telepathy as being a perfectly normal or acceptable thing, and then went straight in because this was, you know, as the Avengers kind of was transitioning from being basically a kind of crime investigation espionage show into something that was much more flamboyant and eccentric, and so took the idea that there were experiments going on and there were organizations who were concerned with using telepathy for good or ill.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't work in that context, but this is remarkably similar in a sense, because here we have the villain who is possibly a psychic murderer, and we have this department who are doing investigations into both the nature of, I don't know what we're calling it, but
Well, this is called psychic phenomena.
Psychic phenomena, telekinesis, all the kind of things they might be interested in, as well as the kind of malevolent practitioners of it.
Well, I think it's probably Ben and I had this discussion on one of the episodes of UFO as well, that there was a time, and obviously, you know, science that leads to the wrong conclusion is bad science, so we won't... I won't try to typify it as okay, but there was a time in the 60s and into the 70s that there was a number of published works from actually sort of supposedly credentialed places that were beginning to show that psychic phenomena were real. And so you had this influx of programs that started with the idea of, well, now that we know that there's actually something to this, and so that in a way is sort of their science fiction, because psychic phenomena was science, or thought to be on the verges of being science. And of course, what happened is that after that initial amount of research and some confirmation bias, then more research has basically debunked it. And also debunked the techniques that were being used as being improperly controlled. And so, and researcher bias, conscious or unconscious. And so now, hopefully, anyone listening to this podcast knows it's complete bollocks. But, you know, your dog does not know that you're coming home psychically before you get there. That is not what's happening.
I remember you saying that, and it was a very interesting discussion. And I think that we also may have touched on it when we were talking about the prisoner.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, that's right.
When you look at this in terms of its time, you're talking about things like the kind of left brain, right brain stuff, that actually someone in his profession might well have been legitimately talking about then. And we're watching it now with the benefit of hindsight and the knowledge of research since done. But that doesn't necessarily detract from it as a drama, if you can get past that.
If you can put yourself in that mindset, that's right. It's a difficult thing to do for some people. It's kind of,
it's suspending disbelief, which is what we have to do anyway.
I like to compare it to a Sherlock Holmes novel. So not that it's on that level, but in other words, if you read a Sherlock Holmes novel, an actual Sherlock Holmes novel, they don't explain gaslights. They don't, they don't have to explain a Hansen cab or anything, like, because that's what the contemporary audience has in their, in their mind is what the normal world is. So it's any more than they're just describing, well, he put the coffee cup down on the table. Well, we all know what a coffee cup is, and we all know what a table is. And so you don't have to go into that. Whereas in a science fiction story, if they start talking about a particular doodad, they have to explain it. And a lot of times, if somebody wrote a Sherlock Holmes story today, they would be inclined to give some information.
Discuss the period details.
Yes, because you can't help do it. So we're watching the show, 79 period details, and if you can just put your mind in it, and I don't think it's that difficult to do, then you just go with it and you don't laugh. You don't go, oh, come on, you're not trying to put this over. But heck, the X-Files, after all this stuff was pretty much thoroughly and utterly debunked, still managed to do a good job of it, conveying it on screen. But it also led to a lot of people actually believing in that stuff, and more instances of UFO sightings and ghost sightings and things like that that are directly attributed to the popularity of the X-Files. But still,
then again, I suppose those two shows are not so far apart. The X-Files is a lot. Is longer ago than the gap between the Omega Factor and the X-Files, which is a slightly scary thought. But at the time they made the X-Files, they were very careful to use the type of story that fitted in with the public perception of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So they were slotting it into the the context, and like, and it's exactly like you say in terms of the audience's expectations. So the there would be a certain amount of knowledge about this. Of course, most of the audience, well, I don't know about most of the audience, many in the audience would be able to look at it and say, well, of course, that's complete fiction, that's fantasy, but then I'm watching a fantasy show and that's fine. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, care's taken to make sure that it doesn't obviously and directly contradict things that are widely known.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, in the X-Files, there are ghosts, and they are, or aliens,
and genies, and
oh yeah, genies. That's particularly bad. Yeah,
I love that one.
In terms of its plausibility, it was pretty low on the scale, though.
I think plausibility was never a strong point in the X-Files, but they treated it as if it was serious. And this one, you know, is again absolutely treating it as if it's serious. And you know, that works a lot better for me. That the idea of Department 7 sits a lot more easily than some of these kind of slightly more zany secret organizations like Shadow or Torchwood.
True. Those are pretty absurd secret organizations. I will fully and freely agree, particularly Torchwood in their Torchmobile, but very secret anyway. Do you think Tom is the only psychic that's going to be at Department 7? That everyone else is a researcher, or do you think like Anne is going to be psychic too, or some of those people have?
My feeling is we might see other people with at least levels of psychic ability. I don't know about Anne.
I get the feeling that in 10 episodes' time, there's going to be a romance between Tom and Anne?
Oh, I'm certain there is a.
Is it just for that line about?
I don't know if there's going to be a romance, but obviously, I think what we know and what we knew going into it was who the kind of leads are, or whose performance is remembered in this. So I think that's going to be quite important.
But does it have to go down that path? Can they not just be two colleagues?
No, I don't think
that. A friend of his wife who, you know, is not dead that long, and but they did set her up with that line from the guy who's obviously her boyfriend when he said, "Well, you know, I've been trying to get her to." That filling out two tax forms is easier than one. And she keeps resisting, so that tells me, you know, in a relationship, but not ready to get serious.
Yeah.
So if they'd been married, I would say we'd put this right out that they were not going to have that sort of tension. But because they made a point of it, it is.
I think we're going there, and I kind of don't regret it because you know if. That was what made that. I don't know where it'll go, but the fact that there is some tension, there is some interest, is what made, for example, the X-Files.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that was the longevity of the show while
they managed to avoid it.
Yeah, yeah. It was while they managed to avoid it, and while they managed to hang on to Duchovny and Anderson in the roles.
Right.
So, yeah, I think Louise Jameson, I thought that was really I'm pretty sure I haven't seen her. I'm ever so familiar with her in the role of Leela,
mm-hmm.
you know, not just having watched her episodes from TV Doctor Who a number of times, but the fact that the character has appeared in lots of the spin-off audio series that Big Finish make.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I've actually seen her in anything else. I don't remember her in Tenko, of which I've only seen an episode or two anyway.
I think I've only ever seen her in Doc Martin.
Is she in that?
Not a lot, but she's Doc Martin's wife's mother, who comes in once in a while.
Mother, I feel old. But I'm curious to see more because I recognized her voice instantly physically, it's an incredibly different performance from Lena. I don't just mean the fact that she's not wearing skimpy animal skins and brandishing a knife, but there is something really quite different about
her. It's like
her.
She's acting.
Well, but she she was as Lena, but it was a very different kind of a role. I think this. I thought.
Well, you know, there are some actors who have one performance, and then there are other actors who are actually gifted at their
craft.
Oh,
see what you mean? Yeah.
She's doing. My wife fought the whole episode trying to figure out who it was. She knew who it was. Yeah. She kept saying,
"I know her.
I know that voice. I know that actress." And I went, "Yep, mm-hmm." And it took her quite a while, and then finally, maybe halfway through, after Anne appeared in the show, she's like, "She's a companion of the Doctor, isn't she?" I'm like, "Yep, mm-hmm." And then right about the funeral, she got it. Oh, that's Leela, isn't it? Yeah.
And you see someone out of context. It's like you meet someone from work in the pub or whatever, and your brain can't process, you know.
The fact that they're sitting there in a cape with a hat and a big... And,
yeah, exactly.
Flamboyantly carrying on.
But you know, despite the fact that she wasn't wearing her animal skins and so forth, there's something very sexy about the character of Anne.
But she's much more sophisticated than Leela.
Yeah.
Leela is playing, you know, if not a... Leela is playing an innocent more than she's playing a wild animal, which, I mean, obviously if you were making this in today's era, you would probably make Leela a little bit more of the wild animal to get a little more of the sex out of it. But not in Doctor Who.
But no one watching either show would escape the fact that, you know, Louise Jameson is an attractive woman.
I think
you're right. There is something, because I think Leela is a very interesting character, and works well as a contrast to the Doctor. But there's something very different about the character of Anne in this story.
Yeah. So we'll see how that goes. I do not have anything else on this episode.
Me neither.
So I guess then. Wait, I do have one thing else. The title, The Undiscovered Country. If I'm not mistaken, from my limited American education on Shakespeare, that is death, is it not? Is it Hamlet, where he refers to the undiscovered country?
You know, if you hadn't told me, I would have gone, I have no idea, but that does ring a very slight bell.
I'm going to have to look that one up.
Yes.
Unfortunately, it's also the name of a Star Trek.
I must also admit my own ignorance.
Which comes up far more often than Shakespeare. Well, okay, fair dues. No Fear, Shakespeare, Hamlet, Act 3, Scene 1, Page 4. The undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveler returns puzzles the will and makes us rather bear those ills we have. So that is definitely one of those major Shakespeare-y lines. Yeah. Okay, so it is death, and it's...
There you go. Jack Gerson's absolutely right not to underestimate the audience he has in you.
You know, he has no Wikipedia entry.
Gosh.
I said I didn't look at the Wikipedia entry for the Omega Factor and it's true, I did click the link, and you know how Wikipedia on a TV show on the right has a little box that says, like, years, writers, directors, number of episodes? I looked at that box, and I noticed that created by Jack Gerson, and absolutely no link of any kind for him. So I don't know if that means this is his only work. I didn't try IMDb or anything like that. I got that far. I pulled it up and I said, wait, I don't want to read the Wikipedia article. So I just kind of shifted my eye over to the side and looked at that so that I'd have enough to, you know, not be an idiot when we started the podcast and say the 1970-something TV show. And then it turned out I didn't bother to look at the head actor's name. So same difference. But I didn't care about him. He's just Blake with a slightly skinnier face. And then when... because of the hair.
And doing some acting.
I know. Gareth Thomas deserves a lot of the stick he gets in Blake 7 because he is apparently a very good actor, but I guess he was just phoning it in a lot of the time on Blake 7. Some days he just, I think he felt it was beneath him and and it shows. Whereas Paul Darrow was having the time of his life. So, anyway. All right, well, Simon, I'm looking forward to the next episode.
So am I.
And thank you for joining me.
Go watch it now.
Oh, well, but I don't know how long. Yeah, all right, fine. We can do that. You can do that. All right. And so thank you for joining me.
A pleasure, as always.
And listeners, I hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol. Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us? Leave us a review on iTunes, or stop by and visit us at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fusionpatrol. Our Twitter username is @fusionpatrol, or you can just send us a comment at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Come check out our new YouTube channel at youtube.com/fusionpatrol. Please, come join the conversation. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.